Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my faithful, long-suffering companion,
Mark Matzke.
This is Monsteropolis, the official show of Small Town Monsters. We are broadcasting not live, but pre-recorded on 97.1 FM in Wadsworth, Ohio. And obviously you're listening through the podcast or the radio station. I don't know where I'm going with
this. I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Or it's being beamed directly into your brain. The biggest thing, I start to sound like a cartoon character stuttering. If you're enjoying if you're enjoying the show, make sure you're leaving reviews on iTunes or Podbean or wherever. If you have like a preferred podcatcher and we're not on it, can you let me know, listener, dear listener? Because some of these podcatchers, we actually have to go in and manually submit the show to them. We're trying out a new audio setup this week. If there are any quirks in the audio setup, fear not. We'll be working them out in the weeks ahead. But for now, we're finding our way with a whole new mixer after like 7 or 8 years with our previous setup. So this week, the next three episodes are going to be related to
vanishing
folk,
vanishing people.
Yeah. And there's a fourth episode coming as well at the end of the month. I don't know why I'm saying this, but by the time they listen, they're gonna have already heard it. We want to get into this week something a little not as paranormal as our usual subjects, although I think at least one of these that I have goes in that direction. Well, I guess two of these goes in that the more like paranormal direction. But yeah, this week's subject is mysterious disappearances. What did you think of this subject when I initially said something about doing this?
Well, I was interested in doing it, but you know, these days all your thoughts go immediately towards missing 411. I mean, that's become a cottage industry.
It's hard to do research and not just come across missing 411 videos and articles.
Yeah, right. Right. But what was really kind of eye-opening to me is that in the Freudian literature, this has been a genre long before missing 411 came along, and it seems to go in different waves. And just the most unsettling part about it is that it seems one consistency is the vanishing of children over time, which is really kind of disturbing. I mean, this is probably a topic about which I get the most unsettled.
Yeah,
to be honest. I mean, after doing research for this show one night, I was about as creeped out as I get on these topics, and we'll get into the case that gave me the heebie-jeebies.
You must have gone a different direction with your sort of research than I did, because I went more, I don't even know that I wasn't purposefully looking for sort of like esoteric or creepy cases or anything like that, and mine are, there's one at the very beginning here that I'm a big fan of that I wanted to talk about, but I don't know that there's a connecting thread between the four I've got. So maybe there is for you. if you went more in that like missing 411, like vanished out of thin air kind of.
Well, direction. Some of that, but also a few historical reports mm-hmm. too, that I think one of them, if you're not familiar with it, I think you'll really like it.
It's not David Lang, is it?
No, okay, no.
He's my first.
Yeah. Well, I have David Lang on the list.
I've been aware of that forever. And yeah. I've always really liked that story.
It's a great story.
But I found some things about it that sort of debunk aspects of it.
Oh, sure.
Well, which I wasn't aware of. But yeah, let's, why don't you start us off then? Some of those historical ones.
Okay. Well, some of these are just super thumbnail anecdotal. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot
that's
of
the way
them.
With me. Yeah.
The first one that caught my attention, and I tried to do some corroborating research on this, I didn't find anything at all. So
those
take
are
it
the best.
For a grain of salt. But it's from the London Daily Chronicle, July 30th, 1889, only identified as Mr. McMillan, which is affiliated with the publishing. They're linked McMillan, in this little report. On July 13th, of 1889, had climbed to the top of Mount Olympus. What Mount Olympus is not specified, but climbed to the top of Mount Olympus, was seen waving from the summit, and then no trace of him was ever found again. Now, it would seem to me that Mr. McMillan of the publishing giant that it became, that would be
common
news somehow, that would survive into the current era.
She couldn't find anything as to what happened to him.
Nothing. All I found was that little blurb. But it does sort of, I mean, it puts dates and places and famous names in there. You would think that would show up somewhere else.
Strange.
Yeah.
Someone that famous too would,
right.
You would almost expect there to be more information about what happened to them. Mm-hmm. I don't get that.
Now another historic.
What year was that?
1889.
Okay.
And sort of that same era, this is the one I thought you might enjoy, is a man, Benjamin Bathurst. Mm-hmm. Did you get into that at all?
No.
Okay. On November 25th, 1809, Benjamin Bathurst went to enter a horse-drawn carriage, stepped around the heads of the horses, like to get in through the other way, and vanished and was gone completely.
I have heard
evidently.
That. I've heard that one.
And the more you dig into this story, it becomes a very, it's a story of intrigue and spies and things like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Bathurst ended up being British intelligence. He was actively serving in Prussia during the Napoleonic Wars. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole chapter in a book by Lionel Fanthorpe that gets into four theories on what actually happened to him. And he kind of comes out at the end and says, when they demolished the inn where this whole thing took place, they found a skeleton, and they think that it's Bathurst, that somebody who worked there
killed him
and buried the body and concocted the story of him vanishing out of thin air. But it's really fascinating because you get into sort of this cloak and dagger of the early 1800s stories. At Benjamin Bathurst, if you want to look that up, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'm curious how involved was he with, I mean, was he just a straight up spy for?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so someone killed him.
Right.
That's an interesting story to try. Your alibi. Oh, he just disappeared.
Yeah,
right. Right in front of
me. He vanished into thin air. Happens a lot.
Well, as long as we're on these old ones, so I mentioned it, but David Lang, And this, I'm probably going to read this mostly. This is pulled from hoax.com, so you can probably already tell where I'm pulling my information from. But David Lang was said to be a farmer who lived near Gallatin, Tennessee. On September 23rd, 1880, he supposedly vanished into thin air while walking through a field near his home. His wife, children, and two men who were passing by in a buggy all witnessed his disappearance. Frank Edwards included the following description of Lang's disappearance in his book Stranger Than Fiction that came out in 1959. David Lang had not taken more than half a dozen steps when he disappeared in full view of all those present. Mrs. Lang screamed. The children, too startled to realize what had happened, stood mutely. Instinctively, they all ran toward the spot where Lang had last been seen a few seconds before. Judge Peck and his companion, the judge's brother-in-law, scrambled out of their buggy and raced across the field. That's a part of the story that isn't, this isn't set up too well, but basically a man was walking into a field, his family is watching him. There's two men approaching on a carriage that supposedly saw this as well. The five of them arrived at the spot of Lang's disappearance almost simultaneously. There was not a tree, not a bush, not a hole to mar the surface, and not a single clue to indicate what had happened. The grown-ups searched the field around and around and found nothing. Mrs. Lang became hysterical, had to be led screaming into the house. Meanwhile, neighbors had been alerted by the frantic ringing of a huge bell that stood in the yard, and they spread the alarm. By nightfall, scores of people were on the scene, many of them with lanterns. They searched every foot of the field in which Lang had last been seen a few hours before, stamped their feet on the dry, hard sod in hope of detecting some hole which he might have fallen, but they found none. David Lang was gone. He had vanished in full view of his wife, his two children, two men in the buggy. One second he was there, walking across the sunlit field. The next instant, he was gone. Eventually, the grass around where Lang had disappeared turned yellow in a 15-foot diameter circle, suggesting that some form of energy had mysteriously transported him away. 7 months later, his children were said to have heard their father's voice faintly calling out for help as they played near the spot of his disappearance, but eventually the sound of his voice faded away. They never heard his voice again. There's an interesting source of this, and they call it a legend, source of the legend, and it seems like it was more than likely inspired by a legend or a story called The Difficulty of Crossing a Field that was in a book by Ambrose Bierce. It was in a book called a collection of stories called Can Such Things Be from 1893. Bierce's story describes a plantation owner who vanishes into thin air. In his 1953 article, Palmer claimed that Bierce's story was inspired by the Lang incident. So it's hard to tell who's telling the truth here, but basically Palmer's claiming that Bierce's story was inspired by a true incident. It's kind of the perfect legend because there's no way to debunk it then. Like you'd have to, it's too old to really be able to find corroborating evidence that, you know, like the family's all gone unless someone magically wrote down something about their father disappearing into thin air.
Well, there is somewhat of a rest of the story to this.
No, Mark.
Yes, there is.
Mark, I do so much in-depth research. It's not, there was nothing left. I turned over every rock that hoax.com had.
One thing that this is just a weird point of trivia, but Ambrose Bierce himself disappeared under mysterious circumstances in Mexico.
I knew that. I just didn't.
You didn't want
to. Didn't want to include it in my notes. I was like, that's too much of a rabbit trail.
Yeah, this is irrelevant.
Yeah.
So this David Lang, what's really kind of wild is that Fate magazine in July 1953 ran a piece titled "How Lost Was My Father?" Supposedly a firsthand account of the event by Sarah Lang, based on a 1931 interview with writer Stuart Palmer. It further claimed that in April 1929, Sarah received a message via automatic writing. Message in her father's handwriting said, together now and forever, after many years, God bless you. To Sarah, these words meant, mother and father are together now in the world beyond after the nightmare years of separation. So this Fate magazine claimed to be, this article claimed to be an earlier interview with one of the daughters. Mm-hmm. So this sent a Nashville librarian by the name of Herschel Payne on a fact-finding mission to try and validate the story. He found no archival evidence that a Lang family or an August Peck had ever lived in the area. Eventually, he concluded that the tale's genesis was in a journalistic hoax engineered by traveling salesman Joseph Mulholland, who in the late 19th century contributed far-fetched yarns to various papers under the pseudonym Orange Blossom. Mm. In Payne's view, Mulholland probably had based his joke on a science fiction story, the aforementioned Difficulty of Crossing a Field. Yep. By Bierce, one later chronicler, J. Robert Nash, added to the confusion by suggesting that Bierce's story, set in 1854 in Selma, Alabama, concerning a planter named Williamson, was the true one. In fact, there is no more reason to believe the Williamson story, which Bierce never pretended was authentic, than its Lang variant. Palmer's fate account, credited to Lang's daughter, contains what are represented as samples of the victim's handwriting, automatic writing, signatures by Sarah, and a notary public. Investigator Robert Schwadewald showed these to Minneapolis handwriting expert Ann B. Hooten, mm-hmm. who studied them and declared all were, quote, authored by one individual, unquote, presumably Palmer. Sarah Lang, in other words, was as much a figment of the hoaxer's imagination as was her father.
Okay, so that definitively kind of debunks the Lang account. It doesn't make it any less of a great story, I don't think.
No, and it spun off other stories that were almost identical.
How did Bierce disappear? Like, what were the circumstances?
I don't know. It was later in his life, okay. and he just seemed to have gone to Mexico.
If you're going
to
go to Mexico, it's a pretty good chance
yeah,
you're
going
to go.
Yeah, that's...
probably holds truer today.
Right.
I've always loved that story. There's the element of the children going to the same location and hearing their father months later, like disembodied. It's always been such a creepy aspect of that legend, but one I really enjoy. But yeah, that's my historical account.
But it kind of sets a pattern that, I don't know, involuntarily has been followed, is this idea that you can be here one minute and gone the next, mm-hmm. and even have eyewitnesses. I mean, there's weird reports like that to this day, and sort of on the outskirts of the Bigfoot topic, you know, there's,
oh yeah,
the wormholes or what have you, portals, yeah. and that goes all the way back to this, and probably yeah. even further back. I mean, there's a whole thing that we could connect to this. I'm not suggesting we do necessarily, but of like the fae folk and mm-hmm. fairy stories, fairy rings. If you go inside the ring, you can be heard but not seen.
We should do an episode on fairy lore and all that, and call in Joshua Cutchin.
Let's go to Oliver Lurch, because this is kind of connected.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same in a way. It's sort of the Lang story as an early urban legend, because you have all these variations on a theme. This one is Christmas Eve, 1889, 1890, or 1900, on a farm outside of South Bend, Indiana. Friends and family have gathered for a holiday party. At one point during the evening, Oliver Lurch, or Larch, age 20 or 11 in some versions, sets out to the well to fetch water. It's a clear night. Clouds have passed earlier after the dusting of ground with snow. 5 minutes later, horrible screams interrupt the Christmas celebration, and everyone dashes outside, where they see Oliver's tracks suddenly disappearing halfway to the well. A voice apparently emanating from the sky through its source is not visible screams, "It's got me! Help, help!" The pathetic pleas fade away after a few minutes, and Oliver Lurch is never seen or heard again. The facts of this case, one chronicler asserted, are clearly written down for everyone to see in the police records. An identical tale, differing only in the name of the victim and location, is told of 11-year-old Oliver Thomas of Wales. This version, apparently of recent vintage, first appears in true mystery paperbacks in the 1960s. Subsequent archival investigations have established conclusively that Oliver Thomas never existed. And so it goes through, you know, all these permutations. Story's plot comes from an early science fiction story, Charles Ashmore's Trail, published in an 1893 collection by, guess who? Ambrose Bierce.
No.
Yes. Can Such Things Be, set in Quincy, Illinois, November 1878, tells of the title character's ill-fated trip to the well and of his family's horrified discovery of tracks that abruptly ended and all beyond was smooth, unbroken snow.
So there's a whole subgenre of this.
Yes, there are. That's and it cool. and it seems Ambrose Bierce seems to be like the linchpin of the whole thing, that numerous stories from the same collection spun off into tales that were told as true.
Interesting. So Bierce was sort of the, oh, I gotta watch what I'm about to say. Never mind. hate mail. Can we talk about Earhart?
Yeah, of course.
So, as long as, because most of this stuff so far has been very Fortean, and Earhart isn't necessarily Fortean at all. Mm-hmm. But this is not a topic we normally would have managed to get in on the show, so I did want to talk about it. How much do you know about Amelia Earhart?
Oh, like the Scholastic book
that's
version.
The way with me, yeah. I just know that she disappeared while she was in a plane, essentially. Mm-hmm. But so that's interesting to me because of the fact that the story's become such a, it's taken on a life of its own. Like, it's really a fairly mundane incident. Someone flying across the ocean, their plane went down and they never found the body in the ocean. Like, what do you expect? But it's like every I've got a brand new story that just ran recently that I'm going to read in a second anyway, but like there's, it seems like people are really obsessed with trying to discover what actually happened mm-hmm. to her, when I feel like what actually happened to her has to be fairly obvious. Right. I think we're going to talk to Scott Philbrook a little later from Astonishing Legends about this incident, and he'll maybe shed some light on that. But Amelia.
Well, you're right. I think, you know, in recent times, there's every so often you hear an update or like an addition indicating that, you know, she survived somehow. Yeah. And, or that more information was discovered about what she went through.
Yeah.
A meteor of the Atlantic won over the treacherous Pacific. Roaring into the Oakland airport, she brings to a triumphant finish her 2,400-mile hop from Hawaii after 18 hours in the air. 10,000 cheer the end of the epical flight as the Lady Lindy slides into a perfect landing with two records. The first woman to fly the Pacific and the first person to fly it solo. She receives one of the most tumultuous greetings ever accorded a flyer. Roses to Amelia and the plaudits of the world to a veteran of flights that have shown the way for aviation's progress. It's her most brilliant chapter in a 16-year aviation career.
It's interesting to me, like things like this are something we can never really get to exploring with Small Town Monsters, but how someone like Amelia Earhart becomes such an iconic character in American history, you know, like when really it's such a tragic story, and like she, you know, she goes disappearing. They never actually find the body, at least definitively. I mentioned the article. So March 8th, 2018, bones found on a remote Pacific island. This was from CNN. Bones found on a remote Pacific island almost eight decades ago likely are those of pioneering pilot Amelia Earhart, new research claims. If true, the findings would finally solve a mystery that has fascinated generations since Earhart disappeared while attempting to fly around the world in 1937. The new study re-examined measurements of several bones found on the Pacific island of Nikumaroro in 1940. Researcher Richard Jantz wrote that what he found strongly supports the conclusion that the bones belong to Amelia Earhart. It goes on and study disputes earlier research. It's not the first time researchers have examined the bones or pondered a possible link with Earhart, who captured worldwide attention when she became the first woman to fly across the Atlantic in 1932. In 1941, the remains were analyzed by Dr. D.W. Hoodless, principal of the Central Medical School in Fiji, who concluded that the bones belonged to a male. The bones themselves have since been lost. How did they lose bones all the time like
yeah,
this?
Yeah, that doesn't...
Like, that's
exactly.
That's kind of a big bones? Deal to lose bones.
People bones, you know?
Yeah.
Human remains. You'd think those would be... There'd be some dignity bestowed upon that. But yeah, I think the interesting thing about Amelia Earhart in one sense is how it's just so quintessentially American. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the compelling aspect of her story is that you've got sort of the progressive, you know, it's a woman doing this piloting mm-hmm. and a leap forward in a way for not women's rights necessarily, but for their place and just doing anything a man can do.
Sure.
And there's also sort of the rugged individual idea that's very American. You know, she's doing this herself, and us Americans love that sort of thing. You mm-hmm. know, like, you know, go do that, go challenge the world essentially with your plane and bend it to your will. But then it takes that tragic twist that she, despite her determination, wasn't able to pull it off.
Let's get Scott in here to talk about the Amelia Earhart case. So today we have Scott Philbrook from one of my favorite shows, Astonishing Legends, with us. And I wanted to get Scott on to talk a little bit about the Amelia Earhart case and where it stands today. But maybe before we do that, Mark and I were talking about why this particular story has become such a popular sort of piece of American history. And, you know, I would like to get your take on that. Like, why do you think there's like this enduring legacy connected with the Amelia Earhart story, and not just her as a person, but also like the mystery of what happened to her?
I think there's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, thanks for having me on. I appreciate your asking me to come on about this. I think our own listeners are, we talk about it so much, they're getting kind of tired of it. So it's nice to go somewhere else where we can still talk about it.
Yeah.
But, but honestly, no, I think it's an enduring legacy for a lot of reasons. I mean, one of them is it's kind of the ultimate unsolved mystery. It's gone a very long time with only really hypotheses about what may have happened to her. And a lot of people would think that if it happened again in this day and age, you know, and her aircraft and navigator Fred Noonan, I think if people think if that had happened now, oh, we could figure it out because modern technology and better search methods. But to those people, I would say, look at MH370, which we still don't know where it is. Mm-hmm. And many, many millions have been spent on that, far more than her probably. But that said, it's that combined with the fact that she was this, you know, pioneering, at the time, the word was aviatrix, you know, she was the original aviatrix, and she was a pioneer ahead of her, way ahead of her time, really, in terms of not only being a pilot, but just being a woman striking out on her own and doing what she did. And I think that captured a lot of the world's imagination. And she sort of was a symbol of America and the added, you know, the can-do attitude and the attempts to break all the rules and do whatever you could to get ahead and be the first to do things. And so to have her go on this trip and also be almost finished with it and then disappear, that's another component of it, is that and I think a lot of people who came along later or who were born way after the fact don't really realize that she was practically home. Mm-hmm. And so that being said, though, the last leg was the most dangerous leg of the trip. But, you know, it was almost a done deal. And then she vanished. And it was right before the war broke out. And so there was all of this speculation, and there's a lot of different theories about what may have happened to her and her navigator. But it is the ultimate unsolved mystery. And then the other reason that I think that it stays at the forefront of American culture anyway is because of the various components of people who are involved in searches for her. There's a couple of them that excel at keeping it in the public eye, which they do because it helps them keep their searches funded. And so there's a lot of press releases that tend to come out every couple of years. And I would, you know, for a longer show, I would debate the veracity of some of them. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is they keep her name in the news and the event itself on the tip of everyone's mind, you know, period. When people it starts to fade from memory and a new announcement comes out and about something that's been found or some new theory. And in some cases, there's some truth to those announcements. And in other cases, it's sort of just to keep some momentum going behind the search, I think.
What are some of the more compelling theories in your opinion?
Well, there's a couple of primary theories, and they all have their nicknames like Crash and Sink and Nicomororo and that sort of thing. In a nutshell, I guess the most prominent ones, you know, the most mundane one is just that, you know, they ran out of fuel and they ditched. There are other ones that suggest that they landed on this island known as Nicomororo and that they were castaways and were never rescued and eventually died on the island. There's another theory that they crash landed but survived the landing at a small atoll and that was in Japanese territory, and that the Japanese picked her and the plane and her navigator Fred Noonan up and took them back to an island called Jalowit, on the Jalowit Atoll. And then from there, they were essentially, I think today you would say, processed and taken to a prison in Saipan and held in the prison in Saipan until eventually they were executed as the war broke out to avoid having to admit that they had captured her and held her for a variety of reasons. And then there is, I mean, the really prominent one is probably the Nicomororo one, but the gentleman behind that one, Rick Gillespie, is the one who really excels with press releases. And he's been to the island many, many times, and he has some very well-educated people on his team, archaeologists and marine biologists, and all these folks have gone back and forth to this little island looking for traces of her and the Electra Tenney that disappeared. And they found some things that are intriguing, but as to how compelling they are, that I think that's a subjective matter. And so there's a lot of folks aligned with that. And the one thing about Rick Gillespie's organization is that it's remarkably transparent. Everything they've ever done is online. So you can dig through it. Any armchair person that's interested in can go through and look at everything. And you just have to, you know, as with anything, you have to consider the source on it and take everything, you know, make your own judgment. And then another theory that has more recently emerged, and this is someone that's been on Astonishing Legends a few times and is now a friend of ours, is a gentleman named Bill Snavely, who took an approach that, believe it or not, had not been taken. He's been working about a dozen years, where he took the course and kind of looked at it backwards from where if she had tried to turn around, because he concluded that her navigator, who was Fred Noonan, who was one of the best navigators in the world at the time, he would have known that they were running low on fuel. And I can get into specifics on all this kind of stuff. If you guys want to know more, just feel free to ask any questions. But the long and short of it is, when they took off from their last departure point, which is Papua New Guinea, there were strong, really strong headwinds. And the other situation or the other factor that was a mitigating factor was that the runway, it was a dirt runway that was shorter than they had expected it to be. And the headwind component. And they were part of the trade winds, which shift every 6 months. And that became known to all, you know, aeronautic and naval navigation about 6 months later. And trade winds are marked on maps now, and everybody knows when they blow in certain directions. But this was before that was public knowledge. So they were expecting a tailwind when they took off. The runway was a little too short. This is Bill Snavely's, this is part of his investigation, concluded this. So as a result, they had to shed weight. So they took a lot of things out of the plane before that last takeoff. And they also, according to Bill and some paperwork that he's found, they were not able to top the tanks off. I think they were able to carry somewhere just shy of 1,200 gallons, and they could only take 950 if they wanted to have any hope of actually lifting the plane off the runway. And my figures may be a little off, so don't quote me on them, but it's something very close to that. So in order to get the plane off the ground at the end of the shortened runway, they carried less fuel. So then imagine them taking off. And according to eyewitnesses, when they took off, it was like a Spielberg movie. The plane like went to the end of the runway and then disappeared down below the horizon. it did not go up. It went down. And then as they saw it, it was out over the water, barely over the water, supposedly carving out like spray. That's how close it was to the water, trying to climb. So they had to do this immense, difficult climb. They barely got off the ground. And then as it's climbing, the other thing they're finding out is that they have this headwind that's more than expected, and it's slowing their ground speed by a significant amount. So if you take all that and you combine the climbing and the headwind and the less fuel, what they're going to be able to conclude and what the navigator's going to be able to conclude is that before they can get anywhere near their next point or their next waypoint, they're going to be too low on fuel to get to it because they burn so much gas just getting off the ground and also fighting the headwind. So Bill Snavely's conclusion was that they would have done the math on this and opted to turn around, because if they turn around, they can come back, they can save the aircraft, and not only that, they can make a second attempt and keep their circumnavigation intact, really. So he was under he came to the conclusion that they turned around, and in the course of turning around, they encountered some bad weather at the place that they had hoped to land, which was a small island called Buka, which is in the autonomous region of Bougainville, which is was part of New Guinea, but politically now it's getting ready to become its own country and separate and all that sort of thing. But it's the long and short of it is that it's most of the way back to New Guinea where they took off from. And he went off some stories that he had heard from locals on that island, where a young boy had seen a plane come down the night that she went missing in a storm. And he was down at the water and saw a plane coming down on fire and had never seen anything like this. And for him, it was sort of an apocalyptic thing. He went back and told the other members of his tribe. The island is made up of several different tribes, and they sort of brushed it off as the flight of imagination, because he was 8 or 9 years old or something like that. And when they went back down there, the plane had sunk. That plane, whatever that plane was, turned out to be a real aircraft and was later found and is sitting in about 100 feet of water off this island to this day. And Bill has been working for about a dozen years to try and figure out what's going on there. And it has multiple characteristics that align it with the possibility of being her Electra. So that's the other sort of recent theory that is getting a lot of attention lately. He's conducted one expedition to the plane and is now in the process of conducting a second expedition to the aircraft. The issue being, after 80 years, that it is incredibly encrusted with coral and concretions that are so thick, you can barely, it's basically a big coral monument in the shape of an airplane. But when it was initially discovered, it was more plain than coral. And so when you combine all the eyewitness accounts and some photographs and you do the various dives, you find out that the wingspan matches her plane, that large aluminum boxes were seen inside the fuselage, which would match the extra fuel tanks that she had. There was a sighting of a briefcase in the cockpit that appeared to have the initials of her husband on it, which it would track that she may have been using that in flight. So there's a lot of things that make this plane a distinct possibility. So that's something that his team is working on that.
Wow. See, this is why I knew we had to have you on the show, because I knew you would drop a knowledge bomb on us.
I'm trying to keep it short. I'm trying to be concise.
Yeah, no, you did great. You left out the mothership picking up her plane as a possible explanation, but that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that alien theory, that's one too that goes hand in hand with the Flight 19, the Avenger right. pilots that all disappeared off the coast of Florida. A lot of people think that was UFOs.
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking a couple minutes to talk to us about the case, and I really want to get you guys both on the show at some point for a whole 4-hour discussion, epic discussion about
tag
all things.
Team
yeah.
Epic.
About all things paranormal and 4TN. So cool. Thanks, Scott, for coming on the show. So what do you got other than Earhart, which was probably the most mundane thing, the most normal sort of thing we'll ever talk about on the show?
Well, there's really sort of two streams of thought. One is the long tradition of child disappearances, and the other is disappearances in the Great Smoky Mountains, which I thought you would
terrifying.
Be
great.
Quite interested in because of your...
I've hiked there so many times. There's so many... Here's the thing, though, about the Smokies. The number of times I've been hiking there and seen black bear just chilling by the trail is too many to count. Like, it's pretty much any time I go and actually do, like, a hike, I see bears on the trail. I don't know why that is, but it's not common to just see black bear out in the forest in other places, but in the Smokies it really seems to be, because every time I go they're there.
Do you think they feel
they might just not be, there's so many people, they might
domesticated
not be,
almost
they might not be scared. I mean, the worst incident that I can recall is I was on, not worst but a little scary, it was like it's on a fairly well-traveled trail, and there were a lot of people. And there was a mama bear and two cubs, like 40 feet from us. And, you know, like they're fiercely protective of cubs. Mm-hmm. So that was a little scary, because you didn't know what was going to happen. But there are a lot of bear, and I know mountain lion too, in the Smokies. I'm also trying to convince myself there's nothing scary about the Smokies, because we go quite often.
And you heard, didn't you hear like a peacock? The Great Smokies.
Yeah, that was weird. We were at a pull off on Adrian and I were at a pull off off the
I don't know, with the Grace Monkey Parkway or whatever. Like,
oh,
the,
yeah. Blue Ridge Parkway, Blue, is that it?
Maybe. Yeah. I'm not sure. But we were just pulled off looking at this view, and we started hearing this really weird call, and I took my phone out and I recorded it, and I sent it to, I think, Mark DeWorth, and he told me it's a peacock. Sent me back the call of a peacock, and I was like, oh, yeah, it's a peacock. So someone in the valley or something had a peacock that was calling, and it was a weird sound, very odd.
Yeah,
also kind of gives you some insight into how easy it is to become convinced you're hearing something unexplainable when there's probably a very rational mm-hmm. explanation for what you're hearing.
Yeah So I there's a really kind of interesting self-published book, I think it is, it has the title's Unsolved Disappearances in the Great Smoky Mountains by Juanita Baldwin and Esther Grubb. And there are some kind of chilling stories in there, and I just wanted to summarize a couple of them, because the first is intriguing for a couple different reasons. Within the story itself, there's some plausible other things happening besides just a vanishing here, one next. This first story is a good example of that. It's on about a woman named Polly Melton. She was 58 at the time. This was September 25th, 1981. There was a regular group of people who lived together in sort of a trailer park situation, very near adjacent to the Smoky Mountains. Deep Trail Creek is the name of the trail. And she was walking in a group of four. She kind of gave her walking companions a strange smile, like a Mona Lisa smile almost, and then started to walk quickly, outpacing them. They kind of called out to her. They didn't know what she was up to. And she wasn't necessarily a jokey person, so this was somewhat out of character. So she walked quickly enough to outpace the group and sort of go over a rise. And by the time the group made it over the rise, Polly was gone. And they thought she was playing a prank, or they just couldn't figure out what was happening. They abandoned their immediate search for her because they just couldn't find her. She didn't appear to be anywhere. And so they sort of fanned out and went back to their homes, checked for her there, couldn't find her anywhere. That night was a clear night. It was low in the 50s and it was dry, so it was conceivable that somebody could stay out in those conditions mm-hmm. and be okay. The local media coverage of her disappearance was almost immediate. It was very intensive. Newspapers, radio, TV, 150 people, it's estimated, were looking for her at any one time, could not find her, and the search was called off a week later. What is added to this story, sort of retrospectively, is there are a couple clues involved with her story, like she always volunteered at this local food pantry that was connected with a church. Normally, she would have called in and said, yes, I'm going to volunteer. This would have been the day after her disappearance. She didn't call ahead of time to say that she was going to be there or not be there, which was out of character for her.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that she made a number of phone calls the last time she was at the food pantry volunteering, which, again, was out of character for her. And all of that, there's more backstory to it, but it leads some investigators to consider that perhaps she was making plans to not be there anymore, that she may have been unhappy in her life, and sort of her final little smile to her friends was her way of saying goodbye to them.
Yeah.
And that she had like a ride waiting or something over the rise. She got in the car and was gone.
Yeah.
Point is, though, as of 1998... no body has been found that would match her description, and no record. Yeah, if her point was to disappear and never be found again, she's succeeded.
Yeah.
At that.
Cool. It is kind of a cool story.
It is a cool story.
I'm glad that it doesn't end in death and dismemberment.
Right. There seems to be no sinister element to it.
Yeah.
Even though it's
The smile.
The smile and. And the short window, really, it's a relatively short window to just completely disappear. Vanish.
Yeah, especially there. Interesting. we got to wrap up, but I would be remiss if I didn't talk about Dyatlov pass incident. I also had DB Cooper on my list. I wanted to talk about both these, but we're already over our limit. Dyatlov has always been, we probably need to just reserve a whole show for that particular case, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. So maybe we'll do that. But DB Cooper is a tale I've always loved about this guy who basically skyjacked an airplane, stole only $200,000, which is really a strange element to the story to me. I don't know if they've come up with a cause of that, like why he would specifically need, or if there's some sort of benefit to only taking 200,000. Like they don't, you know, maybe you're not. I don't know legally if there's something he knew that other people don't. But anyway, he takes $200,000, and then jumps out the back of a plane and is never seen again. Mm-hmm. The money. So three stacks of the money, or three wads of the money, actually did wash up or was found on a beach somewhere. So one of the common themes is that he actually just landed in the water and died, like just froze fairly quickly and died, especially because he would have had a parachute on and he had a bag of money tied to his leg, I believe is what it said. So anyway, that's always been one of my favorite stories. There's a comic book called DB Cooper versus Bigfoot, which is also pretty good. But that's always been a story I really liked. Maybe that's another one at some point we get to and get into more of like the theories about what actually happened to him. There are some like paranormal connections to DB Cooper, as weird as that might sound.
And that's also well within the sort of the American tradition of not the train robber, right. But it's like the modern version of make your getaway.
Robin Hood or something. Yeah. Yeah. Because he didn't hurt anybody.
Right.
In fact, the worst complaint they had about him is that he cursed a lot. Other than that, he's smoking his 8 cigarettes on the plane. And
that'd get you kicked off a plane these days.
These days. But back then it was required. They handed you the cigarettes when you were getting on the plane. This will calm you down. So anyway, final thoughts on mysterious disappearances.
Well, I think you're right that this is a topic that we're just barely scratching the surface of.
I don't even think we're scratching the surface.
We're scratching the epidermis of the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think just in the cases that we looked at today, you see, at the end of the day, it's about a fear that everybody has of what if I'm gone? What if I just am here one moment and gone the next, and whether that's based on a real life story, and there's plenty of those, and they're very nightmarish stories when you know the person who's involved, but it's wormed our way into our thinking so much that we even just write fictional stories and then pass them around as true, because we tell those stories, I think, in part because we're happy to be here. Mm-hmm. And since we're here, we can tell those stories and
creepy.
Feel a little better.
It's the way, it's the same reason I think there's something about it also that speaks to like the reasons people like getting into true crime and all that stuff. I mean, the real world subjects that can be disturbing. There is something comforting knowing that you're not part of that. You're not on the receiving end of these, you know, these subjects. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes. Leave us follow us on Facebook, not Instagram, and on Twitter. You can send mail to us at monsteropolismail@gmail.com. We'll make sure to check the monsteropolismail@gmail.com email address as soon as we are done recording this episode. So thanks for tuning in.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.